Welcome to Extraordinary, coming to you from the Robertson Center at Success Academy in New York City. Built for educators by educators, the Robertson Center brings together believers in the power of public education to deliver on its promise. With the end of the school year on the horizon, we send our thanks to our community of students, family, teachers, and staff. We are so grateful to have the opportunity to work and live alongside you and hope that you're staying well, staying safe during this difficult time. On today's episode, Rebecca O'Neill, Executive Director of the Robertson Center, chats with Jacob Hom, Director of the Center for Child Trauma and Resilience at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and Peter Brown, Associate Director of Crisis Support and Prevention at Success Academy. They talk about the strategies and approaches educators can use to be a support system for all students.
Dr. Hom, so thank you for being here. So nice to be with you.
Thank you for having me.
And Peter Brown, so good to see you.
Absolutely. Pleasure.
Great. So this topic that we're going to tackle is a big one, right? Recognizing signs of kids experiencing trauma and knowing what to do when you see those signs. I want us to get right into this. Before we do, we're going to start where we always do, which is with each of you, if you're game, telling us about a teacher who mattered in your life, right? Somebody who you came in contact with who changed either the way you thought about yourself or the world around you or anything in between. So, Jacob, why don't we start with you?
The first teacher that comes to mind that's relevant for this topic is actually, I think she was my fifth grade teacher. I don't remember her name. I just remember an image of her face. I thought she was really pretty, and I really liked her when I met her and I started the year with her. And I don't know why, but I started to act out. And at some point, she pulled me aside and took me out of the classroom, and she just started to tear up. I wasn't expecting that. I was expecting her to be mad at me and to tell me how bad of a boy I was. And she just said, how could you do this to us? Like, I thought we were friends. And then for the first time, like, instead of expecting punishment, I was like shocked at the fact that my behaviors could actually impact her, that she was a human being as well with feelings. And it completely changed the way I acted with her. It made me try to figure out what I was doing and why. I still didn't figure it out for a long time. But it was such a powerful way for her to have gotten through to me in a way that other teachers weren't able to. And it left a lasting impression.
Peter, how about you? Who comes to mind?
Yeah. So I'm thinking of a second grade teacher, Miss Howe. And I went to Catholic school, and so there was a level of strictness kind of implied in that. But Miss Howe was in a league of her own. And, you know, she had a classroom that was just so consistent. You knew what was expected. You knew what was right, was right and wrong. And there was no getting away with it. If you weren't measuring up, and if she knew you could do better, she held you accountable to that. And I think that's something that really, really sticks with you as a kid, when teachers believe in you and hold you accountable. That's so powerful.
So this topic around children in crisis has been receiving more and more attention, right? Partly as just our awareness of the scale of this challenge grows. Dr. Hom, I wonder if you could help us sort of size up this challenge, right? What is the problem that we're facing? How serious is this, and how does your work at the Center for Child Trauma and Resilience aim to help address it?
That is the largest question you could ask me, actually. If I start on a more proximal level, the issue is way more pervasive than we realize. I think that trauma is actually underdiagnosed in children, partly because the DSM does a really bad job of listing criteria that are relevant for children, because the PTSD diagnosis was made for soldiers who came back from the Vietnam War. And so a lot of children who have trauma actually get misdiagnosed with ADHD, learning disorders, bipolar, emotional disorders, anxiety disorders. And so the prevalence rates are anywhere from like 30 to 75%. And then the more trauma work you do, the more you realize that it all is just about hurt, pain, a lack of love. And then when you think about why that happens, then it's because parents are hurting, in pain, stressed out. And then when you go out another level, you realize that parents are doing that because society isn't supporting them, that we still live in a very oppressive society where class, race, gender, and all these other inequities actually make it really hard for families to succeed. And so you end up having to realize that trauma is just the last symptom of a society that's actually still used to hurting each other.
And so talk a little bit about your work at the center. Sort of how are you part of trying to figure out how to solve this?
I still do a lot of clinical practice myself. And I try to get different kinds of grants that help me to provide innovative services for children and adolescents. Currently, we're funded by the federal government to do some service grants for teenagers who have addiction and trauma issues. Because again, like just like with all the other diagnoses, substance abuse disorders are often the more obvious symptoms of a trauma disorder. And then I also just support programs that are in the criminal justice system, trying to evaluate what works for them. I have contracts with the Department of Education to help the schools be more sensitive to children with trauma. And then just do a lot of trainings across the city to help various people to understand them better.
And for folks who are sort of new to this world, can you just explain what you mean by a trauma-informed approach that is so central to your work?
That's a really hard question, too. There is some science behind it because one of the really fascinating things about trauma research and work is that we've really mapped out what stress and trauma can do to the developing mind and impact like capacity for self-regulation and emotion regulation and things like that. And so to be trauma-informed, you really do have to understand basically that stress and trauma can really dysregulate children at every level, both physiologically, and it can make them like wet their pants, wet the bed, wet, like soil themselves. It can make them lose their appetites. It can make them have sleep dysregulation. So it can dysregulate their bodies. It can dysregulate their emotions and make them more angry or more anxious or more avoidant. It can dysregulate their relationship abilities. So they are more aggressive or they're more withdrawn from and afraid of other peers and have conflict with adults as well. And then it really just dysregulate your capacity to learn and grow. So it just impacts everything.
So as a parent or an educator or someone working for the welfare of children, sort of knowing all that, that then should inform how you're engaging with kids.
Yeah. You definitely don't make it worse. Mm-hmm. Do no harm. Try to regulate how upset children are, how afraid they feel or threatened. And then you really have to keep strengthening the things that kind of atrophy in the brain whenever you've had a lot of trauma, which is like the capacity for self-awareness, self-love, loving other people, having a sense of the future, having a belief in yourself, all the things that like healthy, happy children get. It's like they're starved. Traumatized children are starved on a psychological level.
So Peter, let's bring you into this. So in your role at Success Academy, you lead both efforts for crisis support and crisis prevention for the 18,000 some odd students enrolled in our schools. Can you talk a little bit about those two pieces of the puzzle, right? The prevention and the support and how those kind of relate to each other?
We're serving 18,000 students in New York City and, many of them are coming into our building, having suffered traumatic experiences, and some we're aware of, and many that we're not. So I think our our approach is that, you know, when we have identified a child in crisis who requires support, we want to be there for them. And we're working with parents, we're working with our school psychologists, our principals, really the whole team at the school to make sure that we're supporting the student as best we possibly can. And then on the preventative side, we can anticipate that there are kind of undiagnosed situations, and there's also a likelihood that trauma will impact many of our students at a later point in their lives. So we want to start developing resilience and coping skills and, you know, equipping them to self-advocate, ask for help, regulate their emotions. So it's, you know, it's a two-prong approach where, you know, we're tackling the immediate and we're also trying to look down the line.
Yeah. And when you are looking down the line, so what does that look like in, let's say, an elementary school?
Mm-hmm. So we, you know, we really value being able to provide what's called social emotional learning opportunities in our classrooms. And that is really teaching those critical soft skills, self-regulation, communication, how to solve problems with your peers or conflicts with other folks in healthy ways. And, you know, some of that is for kids who have experienced trauma, it is, you know, going to be strengthening those pathways that have weakened those, you know, those practices of, you know, look, when I'm upset, I don't need to run away from the situation. I actually need to express how I'm feeling and choose one of the strategies that I've been taught by my teachers or by my school psychologist or the mental health professional in my building, you know, equipping kids with a toolkit to manage and stay in the building. So that they can access the high quality education that we're providing. You know, I think that's, you know, something that we think about a lot is that we have really great curriculum. We have really great teachers. But if a child is, if a child has experienced trauma, is impacted by trauma, they might not be coming into the building equipped to access that education. So we need to find a way to support them and teach them what they need to know in order to learn.
When you do think about educators who, you know, have 25 or 30 children in their classroom, what advice would you give to sort of folks, maybe especially folks who are early in their career, don't necessarily know what to look for, or even if they do, don't necessarily know what to do in you know, difficult scenarios?
Well, I think one thing that I think Dr. Hamm, you and I have talked about a little bit before is, you know, you can use the same approach that you would for trauma-informed practices, working with a child you know who has experienced trauma for any student in your building. And that is, you know, one of compassion, one of de-escalation, and to your point, do no harm.
And then I would also say, one, I just feel for teachers. They have a really difficult job and we underpay them for the value that they provide to us. And we undervalue them. And then the thing that I think is really important is to it's to really amplify purpose. And then the mantra that I keep thinking about is like there's this sense of like chanting to every child in your heart, like you're beautiful, you're beloved, you belong, something like that. And no matter what the child is doing, even if they're really aggravating, that's actually how you know when a child has trauma. They're the most aggravating, annoying kids. and it makes it hard for you to want to have compassion for them, like he was saying. And so you really have to cultivate a capacity for maintaining that level of compassion, even in the midst of trauma reactions. And traumatized kids really feel like they're worthless and they're going to like, prove it to you. They're going to test you to show that you don't like them, that you don't think that they belong here and all this stuff.
Can you unpack that phrase a little more, amplify purpose?
When you start the day, you talk about what do you want to be when you grow up? What's going to make you proud? What would make your caregiver proud of you today? What would make you proud of you today? And then you look for that in the kids. And then you high five every time that they show a capacity for perseverance, a capacity to manage distress even when they're being challenged and they feel like they can't do something. And then when you do that, you neurobiologically activate prefrontal function, which has a inhibitory function on the amygdala, which is the center for fear. And so when you're really like amplifying the capacity for purpose and attunement and empathy and self-awareness, then you're actually strengthening the brain's capacity to regulate stress and fear.
Peter, how about you? Thoughts for educators, maybe particularly folks who have a little bit less experience, how they should approach this in the classroom?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing that I would encourage is for teachers to communicate with parents and with leaders and mental health professionals in your building. It's so much easier to work with a child if you have an open dialogue with families and you have kind of a better understanding of this is what the child has experienced, or this is what behavior is looking like outside of school. Here's how family is helping and supporting the child. And then turning to the experts in your building, right? Don't be afraid to ask for help in this, because it is such difficult work, and no one should be going it alone, right? We're a community of educators, and you know, we want to think of ourselves as an educational family, and that includes all the staff in the building, that includes our students, and that includes the families that that choose to come to our schools.
Are there other mistakes aside from lack of communication that educators sometimes make in terms of their engagement with parents around these challenges?
Well, one of the things that that I think about a lot and often try to remind folks is that as a parent, knowing what it's like to have children that at times have behavioral difficulties, you really value when you hear not just about the challenges, you hear about the successes. And even if the day wasn't perfect, it's really important to be able to call attention, both for the child and for the parents or the guardians, something that did go well, right? The baby steps along the way, because you know, trauma is not healed overnight. A child does not magically become their best self in school. It takes time, and we need to recognize progress along the way.
The notion that I see that can be most problematic would be something that's called gatekeeping, or just the us versus them mentality. Mm-hmm. And what stress and trauma actually does to the brain is that it makes us try to figure out who's our friend and who's our enemy. And it can make us make mistakes about that. And so what gatekeeping typically means is like you think that the parents are the enemy and that we're the only ones who can like protect the child. And so we want to adopt them and like keep them for ourselves. And if we could just make the parents like stop being so mean. And in a truly trauma-informed perspective, you realize that like trauma just gets passed down for generations, and that the parents themselves are survivors of trauma as well as most of us. And so it's the us is really all of us, everyone. And then the them is actually trauma, the events of trauma and the way that it just keeps being passed between us. And so we have to team up to mitigate trauma.
So you're both dads. Has becoming parents changed your relationship to this work at all?
Oh, so much so.
Knowing smile you two just exchanged.
So much so. In the crisis work that we do, every time I work with a family or hear from a school that, you know, this family has, you know, suffered a fire in the home, or a parent has passed away, or there's been, you know, an experience with gun violence, it hurts. It hurts that much more deeply, imagining that it could be my kid in that situation, who's lost a parent, who's been displaced, who's suffering, that ability to substitute self for the other, that kind of perspective change that, I think we do it in a different way as parents, but it's something that everyone can reflect on and, you know, put yourself in the shoes of that child or that family, and think about what you would want from the folks who are teaching in a classroom or running your school. It's powerful.
Yeah, definitely. I can, I feel myself, I can't watch bad things happen to children anymore. Like it hits home too much for me. And it's, for me, the experience has been relief and gratitude that I've done so much work in trauma and like healing myself that I'm a fantastic father. It's such a relief. It could have been bad, because I'm still a broken, ugly person sometimes and lose my temper a lot. But the work that I've done to heal and the healing that I've done for other people has really cultivated in me a capacity for patience and compassion that I'm so grateful to have. So that when I'm with my child who's tantruming and throwing stuff, I get at peace with it because I understand, I still feel such love as I'm like helping him contain himself.
So there have been a lot of headlines lately in New York specifically about growth in the number of homeless children. And this is obviously a big topic, but I wonder if there's anything specific sort of about the experience of homeless children that parents, educators should sort of be aware of as we, you know, just recognize this as a kind of a growing problem in our city.
I mean, from prior to my current role, I was working in schools, and some of the most resilient kids that I've ever worked with have been kids who have been through the homeless system or through the foster care system. And simultaneously, some of the most torn up and traumatized and hurt children are those that don't have a place to live, or they're moving between shelters or in temporary housing. And so it's a very real problem. I think we're under-resourced across the city in terms of across the country in supporting kids and families who need affordable housing. It's a problem that we see constantly as families have been displaced, and the waiting list to get into affordable housing is a mile long.
Fortunately, I'm actually part of a grant that the DOE has where we're really trying to help bolster the support in the schools for the schools that have the most students in temporary housing. And so maybe I think that the most important thing to realize is that none of us can appreciate how utterly devastating it is to be homeless. If childhood and the capacity for learning and playing is founded on a sense of safety in the world, then not having a home just takes – it's almost impossible to feel safe without a home. There's no way that your parents feel safe. There's no way that your parents feel like they can even do anything but look for housing, look for shelter, look for like physical safety, trying to figure out where the next meal is going to come from. How much like parenting or reading to a child can you do when you're just trying to figure out where you're going to get the next meal or where you're going to get the next warm bed to sleep in? And so everything gets devastated. And children are incredibly resilient, like Peter was saying. And families still figure out a way to love each other in crises. But at the same time, we have to really appreciate how devastating that is. And then through how much that hurts our hearts to see, we have to act more, like Peter was saying. We're not doing enough.
So last question. We love to read the stuff that smart people we admire are reading. So I was wondering if you could give us a book recommendation, and it can be specific to this topic or just whatever's on your nightstand. What should we take a spin through?
There's two books. If you are really intellectually curious about trauma and its impact, I have three books now.
That's allowed.
The first one, I think, is to read Behave by Robert Sapolsky, because he basically creates a unifying theory for why we act either aggressively or altruistically in the most comprehensive way I've ever seen. Obviously, Bessel's most recent book, The Body Keeps a Score, is a really great insight into trauma and its impact. And then the most beautiful book that I'm reading right now that like breaks my heart and makes me cry and like make me believe in God again, because I was a Catholic boy as well, and didn't like the Jesuits very much, but this Jesuit I'm very proud of is Tattoos on the Heart by Greg Boyle. I'm humbled by his work. I when I was reading it, I actually wanted to quit doing trauma work because I didn't think I could ever do it the way he does it and as well as he does it.
How about you, Peter?
I am a huge fan of Ross Green and has a lot of great works. But the book Lost at School is one that has really informed my approach as an educator, particularly this phrase that he comes back to so often, which is kids do well when they can. And, you know, I think when we think about children who have experienced trauma or kids who are struggling to learn in the classroom, everyone wants to do their best. Everyone wants to feel successful. And so very rarely are the problems experienced in school. Is it ever just a problem of motivation or that someone doesn't want to do something? It's that there's some skill is lacking, or there's some unmet need that we as adults in the room need to really, really dig into and provide for the children. That's our job.
Well, Peter, Jacob, thank you for being here, and thank you for all the work that you do. We're looking forward to continuing to learn from you in the days ahead.
Thank you so much, Peg.
Thanks again for joining us for Extraordinary. If you'd like to keep up with Jacob Hom's work, you can find more information about the Center for Child Trauma and Resilience on the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai website. If you'd like to learn more about the Robertson Center, check us out at www.successacademies.org/Robertson Center. Connect with us on Twitter at RobertsonCTRSA and on Instagram at Robertson Center. Extraordinary was brought to you today by Samantha Williams and her team at the Robertson Center, with production and editing by Stephen LaRosa and me, Joseph Fridman. Our theme song is by Stephen LaRosa. Special thanks to the Robertson Foundation for their critical support, and thank you to every student and educator in our community. The support you've shown one another throughout this pandemic is inspiring, and we are grateful for it. We'll see you soon next time for another episode of Extraordinary.